Inspiring young people through education, environmental activism, and art. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Palm Beach County Schools has teamed up with a research group out of Harvard. Their goal is to reduce absenteeism. So what methods are they using? Well, what if we told you it could be as simple as using a pink flyer in a kid's backpack? Also, Jane Goodall has traveled the world using the power of storytelling to get people to care about the environment and the animals that live within it. She's in South Florida tonight for a speech. We'll talk to her about her life's passion and her focus on the next generation of conservationists. And what are the best ways of inspiring kids who are in juvenile detention? One local artist believes in the power of murals. He's teaching kids to make their own. And finally, it's March Madness, but forget about basketball. We're going to talk with the Miami Herald's Carlos Frias about Munch Madness and the battle over Miami's best restaurant. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, there are a lot of excuses that kids will make for playing hooky. But what if we told you that a pink flyer could help reduce absenteeism? Well, according to Harvard research, it works. Palm Beach schools have about a 5% truancy rate. 5% of their kids are constantly missing class. That's why the district has teamed up with Harvard to get more kids back in the classroom, and that program is called Proving Ground. It's part of Harvard's Center for Education Policy and Research, and we're joined now by the director, Bea Vong. Bea, it's such a pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me on, Lewis.
You know, I remember as a kid, every now and again, wanting to skip school. Maybe it was I wasn't ready for a test. Sometimes it was bullying. But what are some of the reasons you keep hearing, the consistent reasons you keep hearing from kids about the reasons why they skip, why we have an issue with truancy?
I think there are a variety of reasons. When we work with the School District of Palm Beach County, there's a range of reasons that came up. It came from maybe students actually have issues at home that they need to deal with, whether or not that is caretaking responsibilities of younger siblings who happen to be sick. It might be distance to school. It might also be that their parents actually don't realize how much missing school actually affects their learning. So if there's other competing priorities, that going to school that day might not be as high of a priority as it otherwise would be.
And so what are the typical ways that a school tries to help those kids, encourage them to go to class? How do schools deal with absenteeism?
So in Palm Beach County, there's been a range of things that have been attempted. There are partnerships that they have made with community organizations. There are social services that are provided. There's also communications that Palm Beach has tried before. In working with Proving Ground, we were trying to identify the root cause of the issue so that they can actually be more targeted and thoughtful in the way that they could support students and families.
So how is your program helping Palm Beach County schools to reduce the numbers? Because it's worked. It's working.
So with Palm Beach County Schools, as well as with the other seven school districts that we work with around the country, we lead them through what we call a continuous improvement framework. And what that is there's a four-step process that we go through with every single school district, which is the first is sort of to understand the challenge. Where are there challenges with attendance? Is it actually a district-wide problem? Or is it a problem that really focuses on elementary school or transition grades or in high school? So we spend that time sort of peeling the onion, for lack of a better description, of where does that problem exist and where is it the deepest? We then work with Palm Beach County to figure out what are the potential solutions. So in identifying those solutions, we work with elementary school staff and district staff to figure out what are some of the reasons, which are some of the reasons I gave you, of why students might not be coming to school. We then move on to a phase of actually testing the solutions to see, okay, we have this idea of what might work. Let's actually figure out if it works. And in that process, because we're trying to influence parents and students and really help them understand the challenge, we actually include them in the development of those solutions.
And so, you know, what's interesting is so what you've figured out, or at least what you're doing right now that seems to be working, is this backpack flyer. What is that? Why is that successful?
Sure. So in the backpack flyer, when we were talking to parents and students, they might just actually not realize the importance of daily attendance. And what the flyer did when we talked to parents and students is, can you help me understand why, when does absence become a problem for my students' learning? What can good attendance lead to, and what are some things that I can do? And those were all sort of feedback we received from parents. And what we have done, and Palm Beach has done, was create the flyers and send it home so that parents actually have a better understanding of how much their students have been absent, as well as what they could do to support their students coming to school.
You've been talking with some of the parents. What are they telling you? What are those conversations like?
So with parents, some of the conversation has been, I didn't realize my student was absent that many many days last year, partly because it's a cumulative absence. You don't realize that missing 1 or 2 days every month actually leads to about 18 days of missed schooling, which is almost a month of school that you've lost. And so providing that information has been helpful to parents, and actually giving them tips of what they can actually do has been helpful in terms of what are different strategies they could try at home to improve attendance for their own child.
I mean, do you ever, I mean, at any point, just stop and ask them, how do you not know how many days your kids are missing?
We have not asked that question specifically, but from the questions.
But are you thinking
questions,
it?
Sometimes.
Okay.
But I think part of it is really, it's hard to track, right? Like one day you're missing for a doctor's appointment, another day you're missing for a dental appointment, or there's a sports outing, and you just don't realize that all those individual days actually add up.
You know, in again, trying to get kids to be a little bit more cognizant of this and getting them to want to, again, go to class, I'm wondering, in the research you're doing right now, what are you finding that's consistent in why kids are missing? Is it the parental involvement? Is it socioeconomic status? Is it sibling support? Is there any one thing that's jumping out right now?
I don't think that there's one thing that jumps out. Part of the process that we go through with Palm Beach County and all of our districts over the years is that we try to deal with multiple issues rather than just assuming that there's one that prevents students from coming to school. We're trying to figure out what works best for what students and families. So what we have done with Palm Beach County is actually deal with the issue of a knowledge gap. First and foremost, this upcoming year, Palm Beach County is trying to do more deeper work to figure out if there's actually a connection to school and connection to adults in the school. So they're exploring several different ideas that they're working through and iterating with families and schools right now. So we don't have a concrete idea of what to do next year, but that's part of our process to figure out what would be next, to figure out what would work for students.
I'm talking with Bee Vong. She's the director of Harvard's Proving Ground program. This is a program that's been working with 8 school districts across the country, one of them Palm Beach County Schools, and they're working to try to lower absentee rates. And it is working right now in Palm Beach County. You know, Bee, you were approached by former Superintendent Robert Avosa of Palm Beach County. How did he find you? What did he say about how he found you? What was that conversation like?
So part of our outreach is process is to reach out to our network to identify potential school districts that have as their priority trying to reduce absences. So he found us through his general network and reached out to say, you have a continuous improvement process. Attendance is actually an issue for us. Let's actually have a conversation about whether or not your process matches the way we think about attendance and sort of our goals. So we reached out through just mutual networks.
Now, you know, Palm Beach County, looking at the statistics, actually is doing better than Broward County, just south of it, and Miami-Dade County, south of that. But, I mean, what was unique about Palm Beach County? And again, you're working with 8 different districts. What was unique about Palm Beach County?
So I think Palm Beach County brings actually a variety of unique characteristics. One is just its size, and therefore its geography requires us to think slightly differently about how we reach out to families and support them. The other thing about Palm Beach County that's not necessarily unique, but something why we engaged, is that it is a priority. Attendance is a priority. And because of that, and because it's trying to join a network, it was important that all of our districts share that common priority. And third is that being part of this network for Palm Beach County meant that they were willing to share what their successes and challenges are, as with all of our other partners, and that willingness to be transparent, to learn together with other districts that are struggling and or wanting to improve attendance was actually quite important to us, because our network can only be as strong as all the partners in it.
Now, you know, you talk about size of the district. Yes, we do have 3 very large districts here in South Florida nationally. But were you talking about size in the size of the district and how many students, or the geography?
Both, right? So while there's a low percentage of students who are chronically absent and truant compared to other school districts that you just sort of mentioned, that still affects a large number of students. And there's still a lot of days that students are missing instruction. So even though it might be a low percentage, in terms of sheer number of days students are absent across a network, working with that and helping decrease that number of absences is actually important. The other one is sort of the geography. There's a uniqueness in Palm Beach County, given that the Glades is probably different from your central in terms of how many students actually live there, but right. also how do you communicate and support those families differently. So working with Palm Beach to figure out what works for families best, given that diversity is actually quite important.
Yeah, you're pointing out, yes, that Palm Beach County, the east part of Palm Beach County, very different than the western part of the county. You know, are schools reaching out to you? Are districts reaching out to you? Or is it really a lot more effort on your part to reach out to them and offer the service?
It's been a mixed. So we have actually also just recently received an award at the center to run a national center for rural systems called the National Center for Rural Education Research Networks. We're going to be working with 60 smaller school systems to address the issues of chronic absenteeism as well. And so that is because we are New York and Ohio has identified that as issues for their state. And therefore, that outreach is less intensive. In terms of districts, we are now increasing the number of districts that we work with. And there needs to be a match between the district and us. And that match comes from, is it a priority? Is your superintendent and leadership involved? And do you have the data to send us? Because we are bringing at least 50% of the philanthropic dollars for our cost to the school district.
Harvard's Proving Ground program, where did it start? How did it begin?
So it started in December 2015. And the idea behind it was, how do we actually bring our services and to support school district and focus on working with school district and their efforts to support students and families to improve student outcomes? So this is not structured as a traditional research project, even though we're at Harvard and at a Center for Education Policy Research. It's structured in, how do we help build districts' capacity to actually better support their students and schools? And in so doing, how do we help them integrate evidence into their everyday decision-making process? You know, so it started off as an idea of, how do we bring resources to school districts to integrate evidence better?
Looking at some of the statistics that you had, that you had found, one of them really jumped out at me. We have to understand, when a child misses a day of school, it's not just a day, it's actually magnified. And that if they miss 18 days, and I think you mentioned this a little bit just a little while ago, 18 days, it's almost like half a school year.
It is. So across our 8 partners, what we do is we actually analyze to look at the impact of being absent on their actually learning outcomes. So for students in grades 4 to 8, what we found across our 8 partners is that missing 18 days of school, which is about, 2 days a month or 10% of the school year, that's about half years of learning. And when you think about, if you're a teacher and you think about it, when a student's missing one day and they come back the next day, they're not just trying to learn the current day's content, they're also trying to catch up what they've missed behind. So it's just sort of a compounding effect.
Is this the type of program that you come into a school district, you work with them for a set amount of time, you're doing the research because you want to talk to the students, the parents, and see how to make things, how to improve the system, but is it one of those sustainable programs you're in for a long time, or it's, we're going to come in, help them fix this problem, and then we can move on?
So in our relationship with Palm Beach and all of our partners, we look for at minimum a 3-year relationship, right? Or a 3-year partnership, because we want to iterate and improve and work through the issues over multiple years so that we can find multiple interventions that works for multiple types of students and families. Whether or not it's extended longer, that's sort of a conversation that we then revisit with our partners to say, do you still need the support or not? But our goal, in part, is to build the district capacity and muscle to do this on their own.
Realistically, do you think that, right now the absentee rate is again, improving in Palm Beach County, but, how much better can you make it?
So with Palm Beach County, for example, just the email flyer itself that went into a student's backpack has about a 3.2% reduction in absenteeism. If we sort of scale this out next year and use that for all students, they would have gained about 32,000 instructional days, right? So we might not change the rate overall in sort of a large magnitude given how low it is, but it affects students every day. And when we think about another idea that Palm Beach just tried, where there's like a 5% reduction, that's another 7,000 to 8,000 days gained for their students there. So you sort of nip away at the problem.
Bi Vong is the director of Harvard's Proving Ground program, a program that's been working with 8 school districts across the country to deal with absenteeism. One of those is Palm Beach County Schools. Bi Vong, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
All right, still to come. She was portrayed in a film by Sigourney Weaver. Her work has spanned decades, and she's in South Florida today. We're going to talk with iconic environmentalist and conservationist Dr. Jane Goodall. That's next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Dr. Jane Goodall has dedicated the majority of her adult life to the preservation of animals and informing the public about the environment. Beginning in the 1950s, she's traveled to Kenya for research projects on chimpanzees. That research has become the foundation for our understanding of how chimps make and use tools. Now, she's the founder of the Jane Goodall Institute, which is leading the effort globally to protect chimpanzees and their habitats. Dr. Goodall is a UN Messenger of Peace, a UNESCO Award winner, and has been the subject of numerous documentaries and feature films. Dr. Goodall is in South Florida for an event at Florida Atlantic University tonight. We do regret to inform, though, the event is sold out. But if you've got a question for Dr. Goodall, tweet us or post it on Facebook at WLRN Sundial. It's an absolute pleasure to speak with Dr. Goodall right now. Dr. Goodall, thank you so much.
Well, thank you for the invitation.
I appreciate it. You know, you're speaking to an audience in South Florida tonight, and the audience is very aware of the key environmental issues on the horizon. Sea level rise and increasingly intense hurricanes have become a part of everyday life here. When you think about the environmental challenges on the horizon and the preservation of species, especially in the Everglades, what do you see as some of the greatest existential threats that we're facing?
Well, it's very difficult to kind of single some out because, you know, everything is so interrelated, like the problems you mentioned due to climate change, and that's due to, mainly to the emissions, CO2, from fossil fuel burning, but also from the increased amount of meat being eaten, which means billions of animals are now in these factory farms, and they produce methane, which is a very bad gas in these so-called greenhouse gases that are circling the planet, trapping the heat of the sun, leading to climate change and everything that you've just mentioned.
You know, you dedicated your life to educating people about the dangers posed to wildlife around the globe. And yet you see the pushback, you know, from some people who don't want to believe in the climate science. I mean, going all the way up to the White House, a recent survey showed 16% of Americans think there's not enough evidence to prove that humans are impacting the climate. Why do you believe there's a pushback against science?
Oh, the pushback is purely due to economic greed. It's purely to do with big business and every single time that some kind of development, like opening a coal mine, which President Trump is determined to do, like the fracking that's being allowed in the UK, every time something like this comes up, it's the environment that suffers almost every single time. I mean, there are a few landmark victories for those fighting to preserve the environment. The tragedy is that I think when you get the presidents of countries saying they don't believe the science, then their base of supporters are going to believe them. That's the problem that we face.
Some people will, you know, remember the movie based on your life. Sigourney Weaver starred as you in that movie. I wanted to go back.
That was Dianne Fossey.
I mean, Dianne
that was
Fossey.
Gorillas in the Mist.
That's right.
Yes,
right.
I'm still alive. She died. She died in the movie.
Thank you. I apologize about that. There have been a lot of other films, though, documentaries especially, your work. I wanted to go to your love of where your love of chimpanzees originated. I read, was it a toy monkey as a child?
This is a rumor that has been circulated. I was given a stuffed chimpanzee, very large and very lifelike stuffed chimpanzee when I was 1.5. And it was to commemorate the birth of the first chimpanzee infant born in the London Zoo. And I adored Jubilee, as he was called, was the Jubilee of King and Queen. I took him everywhere until I was about, I don't know, 12, 13, something like that. My dream was to go to Africa, live with wild animals, and write books about them. That started when I was 10 years old. When I finally got to Africa, having saved up money, working as a waitress, couldn't get to university because we didn't have enough money, and I met the late Dr. Louis Leakey, it was he who suggested chimpanzees. I would have studied any animal. But then, of course, once I began to learn about the chimpanzees and their absolutely fascinating lives out in the wild, then I was hooked. I mean, 60 years later, me and my research team are still learning new things about that same chimpanzees in the Gombe National Park, and other studies have sprung up across Africa.
You know, we found an interesting National Geographic documentary of your time in Tanzania. This was in the mid-60s. You were initially having struggles finding chimpanzees for your research. Let's take a quick listen to this.
As I am not a defeatist, it only made my determination to succeed stronger. My desire was to be amongst and find out about animals in their natural habitat. There was never any thought of quitting. I should forever have lost all self-respect if I had given up.
Dr. Goodall, when you hear your voice and that determination back then, do you believe that same mentality informs you today? What's changed?
No, nothing. Now my focus is not on the chimpanzees. I have students studying them and researchers. But, you know, if we continue with business as usual, that's the end, not just of what we've been talking about, but the African forests are disappearing. The forests are one of the great lungs of the planet. They give us oxygen, they absorb carbon dioxide, and as we destroy them, all the CO2 they've stored in their leaves and in the soil underneath is released up to add to global warming and climate change. The oceans are also being polluted, creating dead zones. They too are a lung of the world, absorbing CO2 and giving us oxygen, but not when they're so polluted they can't do their job anymore.
I'm talking with a researcher and conservationist, Dr. Jane Goodall, the founder of the Jane Goodall Institute and a UN Messenger of Peace. She's dedicated her career to animal preservation and has the Guinness World Record for the longest-running study of chimpanzees. She's in South Florida for an event at Florida Atlantic University tonight. Unfortunately, it is sold out, though. You can find more resources about Dr. Goodall and her current research by going to our social media, WLRN Sundial. Now, Dr. Goodall, we did get a question from one of our listeners. Holly Lincook commented on our Facebook page and asked this question. Dr. Goodall, what do you see as the future of large mammals on this planet and humans' destruction of the planet that seems inevitable? How do we preserve these species?
Well, first of all, it ties in with what I just said. We have to preserve the forests and other environments where they live. And the Jane Goodall Institute has a program where we are encouraging people to do everything that can be done to stop habitat destruction. And, you know, one of the problems now is the illegal wildlife trade, where tusks of elephants and horns of rhinos, scales of pangolins are being smuggled out of Africa and out of Asia and sold. And they say that the rhino horn illegal industry is worth more today than gold. So we have to try and educate the consumers to stop buying these products, as well as working to raise money to give the rangers on the ground, you know, enough equipment so that they can combat the poachers. So we have a program for young people, the Jane Goodall Institute. It's called Roots and Shoots. There's no time to say why, but it's on our website, www.janegoodall.org. And this program encourages young people, kindergarten, university, everything in between, to choose projects to make the world a better place. One project for animals, one for people, one for the environment, because everything is interconnected. It began in 91 in Tanzania with 12 high school students. It's now in well over 50 countries with about 150,000 active groups. And all the people who've been through the program in school or college and take those values with them, respect for all life.
I wondered, what are some of the challenges that you faced in your life as a scientist, as a female scientist, trying to achieve recognition in a world that's still very male-dominated?
Well, when I first went to Africa, I had no intention of even trying to be a scientist. Women weren't in those days. I just wanted to learn about animals. And luckily, Dr. Leakey, who gave me my chance, he was not keen to have somebody from academia. He said the thinking was reductionist, which it was. And so when I had been 2 years with the chimps, with no having not been to college, he sent me to Cambridge University. And I was immediately told by the male scientists that I'd done everything wrong. The chimps should have had numbers, not names. I couldn't talk about their personality, mind, or emotion because those were unique to us. But I'd learned as a child from a terrific teacher who told me that in this respect, these professors were wrong. And that was my dog, Rusty. You know, you can't share your life in a meaningful way with any animal and not know that we're not the only beings on the planet with personality, mind, and emotion. We're part of the animal kingdom.
You talked about your group, the Roots and Shoots, and what is your take on this? The younger generations and, you know, their attitudes towards the environment and the animals in the world. And we saw one of the largest climate marches in history. You know, this younger group.
Yes. Well, I mean, this is what gives me the inspiration to carry on, because, you know, I'm nearly 85 and people say, where do you get your energy? Well, a lot of my energy comes from our Roots and Shoots groups. We bring them together. They share their projects. They're so full of enthusiasm, determination. And of course, then there's the other groups like this one started by the young Norwegian girl, Greta. And the young people today have a new awareness. After all, it's their future that we're stealing. We've been stealing it for years. And now it's time we get together, work with the youth to do something about paying back.
Something I read about you, I think, was really lovely, is this idea that if you run into someone who disagrees with you or doesn't, maybe you run into someone who doesn't believe in what the science is telling us, that storytelling is a more powerful tool to maybe get them to change their mind or at least think about things differently and not just start a fight with them. But storytelling is important to you.
It's extremely important because, you know, if you do find somebody who totally disagrees, you can start arguing. And then if you watch two people arguing, they stop listening to each other. They're determined that they're going to have the last word. But if you tell stories, then you choose the right story for the right person, which means you must get a sense of who you're talking to, then you can reach the heart. And it's reaching the heart rather than the head that is making the difference.
We've been talking with conservationist Dr. Jane Goodall, founder of the Jane Goodall Institute. She's in South Florida at an event at FAU tonight. Unfortunately, it is sold out, but we've had the pleasure of speaking with her today. Dr. Goodall, thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much, too, and goodbye to all the listeners. And, you know, I hope you'll have another chance to hear me.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Thank you again. And again, we'll post more information about the Jane Goodall Institute. And again, the youth group that comes through that institute called Roots and Shoots, we'll put it up on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Well, still to come, the inside of a juvenile detention center transformed with colorful murals, Hope Murals, coming next on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, imagine for a moment a massive painted mural with an eagle's wings spread and the words "Dream Big." And in the clouds surrounding the eagle are inspirational language like success, goals, and vision. The image I'm describing is not from the walls of Wynwood or a local school. It sits within the confines of the Miami-Dade Juvenile Detention Center, painted by the people in the center itself. Hope Murals was started last year by educator and social activist Herman Dubois. Over the course of a month, Herman works with a small group of young people to conceptualize, sketch out, and then paint a mural on one of the walls in the facility. Now, they painted 12 thus far, and he plans on painting for another full year. You could see photos and the murals and videos of on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Herman joins us now in studio. Herman, it's such a pleasure. Thank you so
much. Thank you for having me.
The origin story behind Hope Murals initially started as a fundraiser for Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria, right?
Correct.
Tell us how did it all get started?
So, as we all know, Hurricane Maria devastated the island of Puerto Rico as well as other neighboring islands. And as a Boricua and somebody who...
Fellow Boricua, I'm with you.
Who was also impacted by that, had family and friends that were struggling. It was difficult to realize that there was little I could do to help. And especially around October, November, you started hearing less about the realities of the struggle of people on the mainland that the media was no longer covering. And there was this sense that everything was okay and back to normal, and that was far from it. And so I had an opportunity to lead a campaign which became titled Puerto Rico Hope, with the idea of using art as a platform to raise awareness about the need for supplies and for support. In fact, we actually were able to raise funds for a local charity called ACT2, which is a Miami-based charity that consists of veterans who work in the disaster relief lane, who were already on the ground working in some of the more remote areas of the island. And so we used the platform of murals, as particularly that time of the year when it was getting ready for Basel 2017, to basically curate a wall, two sides of a building, of a garage on Northeast 24th Street and Northeast 2nd Avenue, owned by Pinnacle Housing, where that became the canvas for multiple artists to work on this idea of raising awareness of Puerto Rico.
And what was the feedback, not just from folks in the community, but from city leaders and so forth?
Amazing. We had...
And the diaspora, by the way.
Absolutely. I think the greatest testimony we had was there were many families that were displaced from Puerto Rico that were in Miami, and many of them passed by the mural, and the emotions that were shared, and the sort of to hear real life testimonies from families that lost everything and were literally starting over, and felt a sense of compassion that others were caring for their situation. Many of the folks on the island really felt that Americans had completely sort of forgotten about their struggle. And so the art became that sort of therapeutic arena for not only the artists and the community residents, but families that were displaced to actually heal and begin the process of starting over.
So how did it go from that into then reaching out to a juvenile detention center and saying, you know what, I could use this? And you reached out to the superintendent of the Miami Juvenile Detention Center and said, this might work here. How did that all happen?
So clearly, the Puerto Rico Hope campaign, which really focused around sort of working with families that were devastated, sort of triggered the idea that hope is a universal concept. It cuts across race, class, gender, regions, language. Everybody, I believe, can understand and connect with the term hope. Some more than others, depending on your level of despair and struggle in life. And art is a safe space to explore concepts that can be controversial, and it can also be a safe space to make mistakes without there being judgment of, oh, that shouldn't look like that and that shouldn't occur. So the opportunity to meet with Steve Owens, who at the time was the superintendent of the facility, came to be, and there was just general discussion around how could art be impactful in that population.
Okay, but what did you say to convince him that this project is going to help those people, the kids in that center?
Well, the messaging of Hope Murals is about perseverance. It's about teaching self-efficacy. For many young people, that are considered at risk or high risk. That's a skill set that, unfortunately, I don't think we as adults in society do a good job of teaching. We don't. We talk to kids about creating goals in life, but we do very little to help them think about how to execute those goals. And self-efficacy is the idea of having that self-confidence to start and finish something. And so when I had the discussion with Mr. Owens, the idea was, we just don't want to come as an organization and have art on the wall and make the place look nice. We want the art to be representative of the messaging that we want young people to embrace as they think about their life beyond the bars.
So take me to that first classroom. You're sitting there with these kids. You've got, I mean, again, you've got kids from many different walks of life. And so, you know, we talk about at risk, but you talk about many different levels. What was the response like? How did you reach them?
It was interesting. Our first session with the young men was challenging in that we're strangers. We're walking in, you know, who are these art guys here? And many of the young men didn't even know what they were selected for. It was just, hey, we were pulled out of lunch or we were pulled out of the classroom to be part of this art project. And so we started talking about art and murals and had some slides going on about art in Wynwood and art around the world and the history of art, but from a very sort of contemporary fashion. Now, I'm a ex-B-boy from the 80s, New York City, and so when bombing and tagging was considered vandalism, although we thought it was artwork, it was able to relate to the young people, and that street credibility came to be.
Because that's what you're talking about is graffiti. You're talking about street slang. The street slang.
Exactly.
Your B-boy. Okay.
Exactly.
Again, talking with Herman Dubois, the creator of Hope Murals. Over the past year, Hope Murals has been working with young people inside the Miami Detention or Miami Juvenile Detention Center to paint murals on different walls within the center, and they've painted 12 so far, have 12 more to go. By the way, we have some of those pictures on our Twitter and Facebook at WLRN Sundial. Please check them out. Okay, let's talk about the process. So you got them to buy in, they're into it, and, you know, how does this work? It's like any artist. It's conceptualize, plan it out, and then do the actual project. But to take me through how you work with these young people and get them to that place.
And so the crux of this is that the entire process is to basically serve as a blueprint for what they can embody in their lives as they think of what their lives could be like when they are released, when they are back into mainstream society and they have a black canvas and they are the artists of their future. So much like artists, as you mentioned, start with a blank wall, a blank slab. We start a discussion around the concept of hope. If a young person had to explain what hope was conceptually to a friend who had never encountered the theme, what would that sound like? And we just start a discussion, and it becomes sort of a freestyle discussion on what that might mean.
But do you find that these folks struggle with the idea of hope, considering where they are?
I wouldn't say that they struggle per se, but I do think that in some instances, it may be the first time they're actually thinking about hope. And in many instances, it starts off with from a macro perspective, talking about hope sort of in a very general way, as I ask them to define or explain what hope means to a stranger. And then I said, okay, so if you had to now explain what hope meant to you, what would that look like symbolically? What images would you create? And so now markers and sketch paper is passed out and kids are just drawing randomly. Every month we have a featured artist that we invite to be part of this, which has become the executive artist for that month. I have our creative director, Chris Collat, who is part of our team there as well, and myself. And we are just sort of working the room and helping kids evolve from their concept to their symbols and images. And even if a kid is artistically challenged, it's okay.
Yeah, are you teaching them art?
At this point, we're not teaching anything about art. We're really more about exploring their concepts and understanding of what hope means and what their vision could look like. Because at the end of the day, the art will take care of itself. We'll get to that phase in the later weeks. We want them to feel comfortable and open about having this honest discussion because many of them are in places of despair. They're at a low point in their life and are what we only have that first session to either get them on the hook or not. And that hook is imperative because that's going to be the basis of them building the confidence over the weeks to come that they can do something that they've never done before, paint a mural.
You know, our producer had the opportunity to speak with a parent of one of these young men who took part in the program. She chose to remain anonymous to protect the privacy of her family, but she told our producer this, quote, "My son was anxious and depressed his first 2 months inside the detention center, but when we visited him the third month, It was like his soul lightened up. He was inspired by this man from Wynwood who was teaching him how to paint murals. And now every time we come to visit, we have something to talk with him about. So how does it feel when you hear these kind of stories and you see the change over time?
Absolutely. This story in particular happened recently, and it was, I have to thank the parent because she tracked us down through our social media and reached out one day and just was so thankful that she believed that someone else had her son's best interest at heart, and that somebody would visit and be a part of his life in a way that she couldn't. And she was afraid for him. And she said, I could not believe how much he had turned his mindset and his actual outlook on what he wanted to achieve once he got out, whether it was going back to school to finish the high school diploma, whether it was taking care of his body and getting back into sports, whether it was planning for a college. She said, we had lost all hope that he was even thinking about that, and something that you guys did just gave him that second chance. And that, to me, I knew we were making an impact, but when you had a parent share that testimony, and I'm sure there are more, if we had the ability to really speak with parents that way, I knew we were onto something solid.
Something else that is very interesting too, another note from the mother and the young boy who spoke with the producer. She talked about the detention center felt very often felt like a prison when she visited. That they don't allow for much affectionate interaction between the parent and their child. How do you believe these murals can help change the environment? Because the environment plays such a big part in helping build this hope.
We had an opportunity to, and we constantly are building relationships with the administration. Miami-Dade County Public Schools has teaching staff there that we have a great relationship with. There are mental health professional staff there. So there's a lot of folks who are that's their home base, and they can't help but pass and see the work that we're doing with the murals. And we actually have an interview on our YouTube channel with some of the administrators there that I encourage folks to read. And they talk about the culture changing. And it's not just the kids. How staff is coming to work feeling positive about being at work. How teachers are incorporating the messaging of the murals into their lesson plans.
Real quickly before we finish up, talking about how you're funding this, my understanding is this is really on you right now as you're waiting for the 501c3 status. And that also you had the federal shutdown, and that
did not help.
That played a role. Yeah. So how are you working this right now? And really, how can people support you?
Yes, it currently has been something I've been personally financing. And I believe that when you're doing this type of work, the ducks will align and the universe will provide it. So at some point, I have received several friends and family members who provided individual donations, from buying paint supplies to offering cash support. We have had some support from the Center for Social Change, who has been amazing in sort of providing us with some seed dollars to kind of get going in our first initial months. But as soon as we get that 501c3, we have a list of foundations that are very interested in supporting us, and we're always looking for corporate sponsorship and new creative programs. But we are committed to not only completing this facility, which is the largest in the state, but we are already having discussions with the Department of Juvenile Justice in Tallahassee about expanding it to 24 other facilities in the state. So we're on the right track.
And by the way, just give the website, because they can find information about how to support you.
Yes, www.hopemurals.org is our website. If you go to our Instagram, @HopeMurals, you'll see the GoFundMe link that is there. And we accept everything from the larger and greater community. Thank you.
Herman Dubois, again, creator of Hope Murals. You could see photos, again, of some of this work, really beautiful work, on our Twitter and Facebook at WLRN Sundial. Herman, thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
All right, still to come, if you checked out the brackets, I know it's March Madness, but no. We're going to talk with Carlos Frias of the Miami Herald about Munch Madness. We'll explain, all coming up next on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. I hope you have your bracket ready. For a third straight year, the Miami Herald's Carlos Frias is hosting his Munch Madness competition to figure out what is the most popular restaurant in Miami. Here's how it works. Carlos creates brackets of some of the top restaurants and specialty foods in the city, in the area, I should say. And each day, readers vote online for their favorite of the two places that are competing in each bracket. The space with the most votes moves on to the next round. The competition is fierce. No kidding. There have been restaurants disqualified for alleged cheating. So we talked to Carlos recently about this year's brackets and the rules.
Without naming names, we did have to toss one in the second year, and we had to clamp down with tighter voting protocols. And the truth is, going into it this year, we just decided that it's just going to be fun. And if folks have a problem with the results, then they really don't have to take it seriously, because you know what? I don't take it seriously. I take it seriously in the sense that I put a lot of thought into it, but at the end of the day, the winner gets a $100 trophy and they get their quote unquote name retired, you know, with the other past champions.
Because past champions can't compete anymore.
Past champions can't compete.
Didn't you have like a hacking issue last year, right? And you thought it was from Russia or something like that?
It was actually Russian bots. I know that sounds hilarious, but that's exactly what it was. We noticed that these online polls were getting spammed with votes, and a lot of them were coming from Russia.
You've got the bracket set up already for 2019, right?
Yes, the bracket is ready. The teams are chosen. The first seeds have all been selected.
You tried something new. You've got four different categories this time.
So what we did is, what I liked to do in the second year was bring back the Sweet 16. And I did that again this year. I brought back the Sweet 16 minus the champion. And then to fill that last spot, it was like the highest vote getter from the previous year. So those 16 that came back, I put them all in a section of the bracket by themselves, like in one quadrant of the bracket.
So all the top teams from last year have to compete with each other right away.
That's right. That's okay. It. That's it. So that we don't keep having the same names over and over. It's an opportunity to just have more restaurants, which is ultimately what I want. I want Miami to be more informed about, you know, all the interesting places out there.
And then what are the other three brackets?
Okay, so the other three quadrants of the, you know, there's 16 in each quadrant. So in the one quadrant, you have those returning teams. In another quadrant, we have what we're calling kind of Miami gems, places that are favorites of folks. Places like Islas Canarias, which is like a classic Cuban place. But then also little places like Black Brick Chinese in Midtown, like Cake Thai, which is this Thai restaurant on the Upper East Side in Little Haiti that not a lot of people go to. It's like there's eight seats inside, you know, but they make maybe the most authentic, using the most authentic ingredients, Thai ingredients, and a lot of people don't know about it. So that's that Miami Gems category. And the other two categories, we have a newbies category, so like new restaurants, places that have, you know, opened in the last year or so, kind of give those guys a chance to beat each other up and see who makes it through the bracket. Is maybe you could call that best new restaurant. Whoever gets to the final four there is best new restaurant, right?
All right, okay, that's true.
And then the final bracket is a specialty. So there's like lots of places that maybe aren't a full service restaurant, but they do one thing really well. And so we wanted to kind of tip our hats to those guys. Guys like Misha's Cupcakes, right? Like they just do cupcakes, but you know what? They do really great cupcakes. They were founded here in Miami. And they had the original store there on US-1.
So that means that one of the specialty restaurants is going to be competing with a restaurant somewhere down the road.
That's right.
And so basically it's just, well, which one can you live with or live without for a day?
If you had to pick between, okay, one of those specialty restaurants is Cindy Lou's Cookies. So like if you've ever had a Cindy Lou's Cookies, they will change your life. So if you had Cindy Lou's Cookies going up against, Tropical Chinese Restaurant, which is a Miami landmark for Chinese cuisine. Somebody told you had to guess and say, you have to live without one of these for the next 6 months of your life. Can you live without Tropical Chinese or can you live without Cindy Lou's Cookies? It's a tough choice, and it should be.
And remind people again, so every day there's going to be voting. Every day everybody can get involved.
Yeah, starting on March 18th, there will have been the voting opens, and it keeps going until we crown a winner in April, the same time as the NCAA basketball championship. We'll keep all the results of each round secret until it's revealed into the next round. And yeah, folks can go to MiamiHerald.com/Munch Madness, all lowercase, Munch Madness. And vote for their favorites.
Carlos, thanks so much, man.
Yeah, my pleasure, man.
And you can go to WLRN Sundial on social media to get the Munch Madness site and vote daily for your favorite Miami restaurant. Well, that is Sundial for this Tuesday, March 19th. I'm Luis Hernandez. Have a wonderful day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.